Hello, this is Kion.
Jeffries is going to upgrade Amazon in 6 minutes.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear that. What did you say?
Jeffries is going to upgrade Amazon in 6 minutes.
Jiffy Pop Hubcap 60 minutes? What does that even mean?
No. Jeffries, the investment bank, is going to upgrade Amazon.
So? Buy stuff on Amazon? I already did my Christmas shopping.
No! The stock, you imbecile!
Why are you whispering?
Because this is insider trading!
What kind of sliders?
Insider! Insider trading!
Can you hold on for a second? Hey, Lydia! It's that guy Henry I met. He wants to do this insider trading thing with me. What should I tell him?
It's super illegal! Don't do it!
She said it's super illegal and I shouldn't do it.
I cannot believe you just yelled that across the room. I'm hanging up now.
Oh, what a grouch. Today on the show, a frontline documentary on that insider trading thing, a piece of satire that fooled big-name journalists, and new research on panic attacks. And now, the guy who accidentally caused the polar vortex, Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, I was doing a little chemistry experiment in my home. It kind of got out of control. I'm really sorry about the polar vortex, all right? I just don't heap opprobrium on me just because I made a little mistake. And speaking of mistakes, we are going to be talking about some intentional mistakes known as insider trading. There's a terrific PBS Frontline documentary coming up. It's actually tomorrow night at 10 p.m., I believe, on most of your PBS stations. Joining us right now are Nick Verbitsky. He's a co-writer, co-producer, and director of To Catch a Traitor, which I say airs Tuesday night. Also with us, Martin Smith, a frontline correspondent and co-writer and co-director of To Catch a Traitor. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
They are in you're in New York studios, I assume, somewhere.
That's right.
All right. And so before we even sort of get into the depth of all this, one of the things we have to talk about is what insider trading is. You know, you and I, we're journalists, and so we're in the business of getting the best information we can and usually trying to get it a little bit ahead of everybody else, trying to find somebody who knows something that other people don't know so we can tell it to other people, which sounds a little bit like insider trading in some ways. If I've got my money invested with some kind of brokerage or through some kind of brokerage, I probably want the brokerage to be as smart as it possibly can, to be buying the right stocks based on the very best possible information. So when does that process become illegal?
Well, the process becomes illegal when the information that you get is actually acted upon. So you mentioned that analogy to your brokerage firm. If your broker gets some information from an investor relations contact at Dell Computer in which that person divulges what their latest earnings call is going to be and gives you exact numbers, it's not illegal for you to possess that information, but it is illegal for you to act upon that information. So that's when it becomes illegal. But getting back to your earlier point about what is insider trading and what is illegal, you know, there's a lot of what's called proprietary or primary research that investment firms do and investors do, things like channel checks to see how many people are going into, say, the Apple store, during a 30-month period to try and divine, what kind of sales the company's going to have. There's nothing illegal about that, but, certainly if you get hard sales numbers from the national sales manager for Apple and you trade on that information, that's certainly illegal, although, you hear a lot of people in the finance business talk about a gray area even in situations like that. That's certainly illegal. So hopefully that's kind of a quick answer to your question.
It's a good answer to the question. Now, the documentary that we're talking about here concerns a series of prosecutions. We're going to be talking a lot about Steve Cohen and SAC. It's not just SAC. This is part of a wave of prosecutions that a U.S. attorney, Preet Bharara, has done, which have resulted, I think, in about 77 insider trading convictions. I don't think he's lost a single case yet. On the other hand, one of the things that becomes clear watching this documentary is that it might actually just be the tip of the iceberg, right? I mean, nobody really knows, and it's almost impossible to quantify how much insider trading is going on. First of all, how did you guys get onto this story? What led you to it?
Well, I think, there had been some rumblings in the press about, insider trading. And then when people really started to focus in on SAC Capital, Steve Cohen, who founded SAC Capital, has been a real you know, kind of lightning rod for all the good and bad that's going on in the hedge fund industry. And I think, you know, when Martin and I talked about the story, we felt like it had kind of so-called jumped the curb, you know, if you will, into the mainstream where people were really talking about it. And certainly it had reached a point, a critical mass, if you will, after the Galleon investigation and all the convictions of Raj Rajaratnam and his associates took place, and all the way up to people like respected businessmen like Rajat Gupta. That's when it really, I think, crystallized for us that there was, you know, something really interesting to be told here, especially as it regards SAC.
There was a really rich cast of characters here. And, you know, the government, as you said, has had 77 convictions, no acquittals. This is a major 7-year-long investigation, and we wanted to pick that apart and really lay it out. We had done some earlier work on sort of the failure of the regulators in Washington to come to terms with the mortgage crisis. Mm-hmm. The fact is that during a lot of that period of time, they were focusing their resources on this insider trading investigation.
By the way, if people have questions, our number is 860-275-7266. No stock tips, please. 860-275-7266. Martin, you know, one of the things that sort of comes out in the documentary, too, is that the Justice Department in this case, they were sort of using a different style of technique than what they might have used at white-collar criminals at that level on Wall Street before. They were treating this whole case more the way you'd treat an organized crime case, right?
That's right, and that was extraordinary. They had in the past used consensual wires, but they had never tapped phones. And consensual wires, when somebody wears a wire and goes into a conversation with somebody. But they had never gone as far as monitoring emails, texts, and phone calls. And that's what they did here. They treated this like the mob. They figured they were not going to get anywhere if they couldn't use those tools. You know, they got onto this, interestingly, by being tipped off to this activity by lower-level sort of players who were running what's called pump-and-dump schemes, where you take a really thinly traded stock and you run it up in value with a bunch of rumors, or you drive it down in value. Anyway, these guys make money, and they're sort of the background noise on Wall Street. And these guys were getting busted by the FBI, and they said to these guys, "Why are you picking on us? Why don't you look at the big dudes up in where you are in Connecticut or on Wall Street, and go after these guys?" And so the FBI, it took them a while to get up and running on this. There's a lot of lingo, and they weren't all up to speed right away, but they started looking at the bigger fish.
Yeah, in fact, there's one really interesting moment in the documentary where one of the FBI agents says, and it's kind of after they've established this wire, he says, you know, we're listening to guys talk, you know, day in and day out about stock transactions in the language that they use. And it's quite possible that we're hearing more insider trading than we can possibly detect, right? Because they have their own way of talking to one another, and you only know so much context. And you even get the sense from them that even though this case turned out to be way bigger than they thought it was going to be, and there's the line from Jaws, they say, you know, we're going to need a bigger boat. But it may be an even bigger phenomenon than they've been able to act upon just because of the very nature. I mean, what we're talking about here are conversations that either go or don't go a certain way, right?
That's certainly true. And you know, I mean, there's plenty of insider trading that can never be detected because, you know, if someone is told not to buy a stock and they don't buy it, that's not technically a crime. So, you know, there's insider trading on that front as well. But, you know, in terms of the totality of it, you know, I think that one of the things that we really tried to focus on here was that institutional level of criminality that was going on here. So, you know, you hear from people like Attorney Duff, who was a former trader, and he really discusses how easy it was to do these sorts of things. I mean, there were certain things that didn't even make it into the film, you know, because they were just specific about other things. But, you know, he talked about, looking at a stock that was, say, at $60 and getting together with a group of friends at other firms and, you know, shorting the stock or putting out rumors to drive it down to about $52 and then buying it. You know, so this was something that – and there was never any, you know, consequences here because – since Ivan Boesky was caught in the late 80s, the inspiration for the movie Wall Street, there hadn't been, you know, any kind of headline-grabbing prosecutions of insider trading. So these guys really weren't thinking about consequences. And that's why I think it rose to the level that it rose to institutionally.
And you make a very good point, Colin, about the sort of fire hose of information that these guys at the Bureau, at the FBI, are trying to get a handle on. And they can't fully comprehend everything they're hearing. The people that are on the other side of the line are maybe cautious about how they're or coding their language. So it becomes a real challenge. And yeah, it is something of a tip of an iceberg. And the agents that we spoke to and making the program say, we think we only brush the surface of this.
Well, you mentioned Attorney Duff, who's one of the more colorful characters in your documentary. Let's hear just a little clip from the documentary that involves Attorney Duff talking about how he found out what it's like to have a so-called Mr. Whisper.
I remember sitting there on the desk one day, and Raj Rajaratnam was out, and the phone rings, and I'm like, Galeon. And the guy's whispering or something, and I'm like, hello, Galeon. And he's like, is Raj there? I'm like, no. So he's like, Jeffries is going to upgrade Amazon in 6 minutes. Click. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm like, oh, my God, what do I do? Because if I don't buy Amazon and the stock's upgraded and the stock goes up, they're going to find out. But if I do it, you know, isn't this illegal? What should I do? And so I sat there for 5 minutes sort of trying to make a decision, and I ultimately ended up buying 100,000 shares of Amazon. 30 seconds later, I made about $500,000. And I remember sitting there saying, wow, I'm like, if I got this call every day, I'd be a great trader too. Okay, you know, I need my own Mr. Whisper.
We'd all like to have our own Mr. Whisper. We're talking about the documentary on Frontline, To Catch a Trader, which is airing Tuesday night at 10 p.m. With us are Martin Smith, a Frontline correspondent, and Nick Verbitsky, a co-writer, co-producer, and director of To Catch a Trader. A lot of the interest of the documentary does swirl around Steve Cohen, who's this, you know, multi-billionaire based here in Connecticut, and his company, SAC. One of the things that happens at the end for people who have been following the news is, although a number of traders within SAC are arrested, are facing trial, have pled guilty in some cases, the only thing that's happened to SAC itself and to Steve Cohen as basically the money and man behind SAC is a fine, right? Explain how this case has played out so far.
Basically, you're right. There have been 7 convictions of former SAC traders, the most recent of which was Michael Steinberg a couple of weeks ago. In fact, tomorrow, the 8th trial starts of Matthew Martoma, or I should say the 8th defendant goes on trial tomorrow, Matthew Martoma, who's charged with the largest insider trade in history. In terms of how it's played out, back about 5 or 6 months ago, Steve Cohen paid a $616 million fine, which was connected to this Martoma trade, which was basically a fire sale and a big short position on 2 drug companies who were developing an Alzheimer's drug together, based on what the government alleges was inside information. Since that time, SAC as a corporation has been charged criminally, and at least at this point, the firm and the Southern District of New York and U.S. Attorney Preparara have come to an agreement about settling those charges. That settlement awaits a judge's sign-off, I think is going to happen in March. But that's going to add about another $1.2 billion in terms of fines for the criminal activity that went unchecked at SAC. In addition to that, there is one large outstanding case against SAC, which is the SEC civil charge against Steve Cohen himself for what's called a failure to supervise the illegal activity that was going on in his firm. Now, what's interesting about that case is that Cohen has chosen to fight that one. The criminal charges and settling it basically are going to result in the fact that SAC will no longer exist as a hedge fund accepting outside investor money. What Cohen wants to do is create basically a home office, or it's been alleged that that's what he wants to do, is create a home office that would manage his fortune, which even after the fines would be in the $6 to $7 billion range, as well as employee money. But one of the obstacles that's kind of standing in front of him is this failure to supervise charge, which could result in a ban from the securities industry for life. So, what's been said about Steve Cohen is that, his life revolves around trading. on Wall Street. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that he's fighting that charge, because to ban him from that industry would basically, you know, to be like, you know, banning someone like Magic Johnson or Michael Jordan from the NBA. I mean, it's something that's definitely in his blood and something that he wants to continue to do. And that case may preclude him from doing that. So we await, you know, the outcome of that case, you know, sometime in 2014.
Although,
but to be clear,
let me just bring this up while you're saying that, though, because obviously nobody wants to go to prison. So you look at these guys, some of whom are going to prison, either have gone to prison or are going to prison. And that's one thing. But, you know, the scenario that you just described, Nick, if I were an unscrupulous person and you said to me, well, here's the plan. We're going to engage in insider trading. It's going to be insanely profitable. You're going to wind up with $9 billion or so. If we get caught, if by some chance we got caught, you might have to essentially pay a fine for criminal activity. You might have to pay 10, 20% fine. You're still going to finish the day with $6 or $7 billion. And yes, there may be some curbs on your future business activity. To me, that doesn't feel like an enormous deterrent somehow. If anything, it feels like a little bit of an incentive. Really? That's the worst thing that could happen to me? If I structured everything right and if I had sort of the right level of plausible deniability, which is what Steve Cohen appears to have, he appears to be able to tell people, you know, I didn't participate knowingly in any of this stuff. Yeah, a whole bunch of people that I supervise were doing it, but I didn't know anything about it. You know, I don't know. Is that an adequate deterrent? He's going to finish the day with $6 or $7 billion, as you said.
Well, you have to roll out that scenario. You're assuming in some way that he was guilty. He has not been charged with a crime. There is the possibility, and I'm sure there's a lot of people listening that would guffaw at this. That somehow, how does this guy set up a company, and you know, the company itself pleads guilty to criminal activity, and he himself, the organizer, the chief duomo of the deal, doesn't know what's going on. That's what he's saying. That is a possibility. And until Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney, can make a charge stick against Cohen, he's deemed innocent.
It's also something that, you know, we do spend a little bit of time exploring in the film, where, you know, I mean, there are a lot of some industries in this country that have statutes known as criminal negligence. You know, there's a story about a gentleman down in North Carolina who was operating an amusement ride and four people got hurt on it, and he's staring at 20 years in prison for it. So, you know, there's this idea that somehow in things like, you know, certainly we hear things about criminal negligence in healthcare, you know, in safety. But somehow when we move to, you know, the finance business, those statutes don't apply. So that failure to supervise charge that the SEC levied against Cohen, which is a civil charge, there is no criminal corollary to that. So, you know, I think there definitely needs to be a conversation about what standard of care are we demanding from people who are managing the livelihoods of ordinary people in this country, pension funds, et cetera. You know, it's one thing when, you know, obviously if there's a violent crime committed and someone is killed, that's a tangible result. But, you know, often we don't see what happens to people who lose their life savings in an insider trading deal or because of something like that or something else in finance. And it goes all the way back to the financial crisis. Right now, prosecutors have to establish this guilty mind, this mens rea, in order to charge one of these people in the finance business with a crime. And, you know, I think at least the conversation needs to be had about a standard of care, you know, regarding the negligent conduct, such as we've seen here with SEC and others, where, you know, the bar has to be lowered just a little bit, where, you know, we're not indiscriminately prosecuting people here. But certainly when it rises to the level of something like an SEC, you know, to me, it seems like a flashpoint for at least a discussion.
You know what? I want to get to that whole question of victims, too. A lot of people have spent the weekend maybe going to see The Wolf of Wall Street and watching Leo DiCaprio sell people stocks that were essentially worthless, just talking them into it. And everybody can understand victimization that way. You give somebody $5,000 or $10,000 for a stock that isn't worth anything. That's victimization. Here, here it's a little bit more complicated, right? Because if you're an investor in SAC and they have all this inside information, which they're not supposed to have, presumably your investment does pretty well and no one will ever come and claw that back from you, right? They'll go after the traders. Maybe they'll go after Steve Cohen. But if you're just an investor who's put money into this hedge fund, you're going to be happy, really, really happy, because they're going to do so well for you. They're going to charge you exorbitant commissions because of all the inside information. But the federal government won't claw the money back from you. So you had to sort of look around and figure out who are the victims here. What did you find?
That's not where the victims are.
Yeah.
The investor in SAC is doing quite well. Thank you very much. So we did look at that. Clearly, I mean, there's an example given in the film of a pharmacist who was buying into these two drug companies that had this promising Alzheimer's drug coming out. Elon and Wyeth were the two companies, and he believed that there was an upcoming trial result that would, he was faithful that this was going to boost the value of the stock and that he would make a lot of money. So he'd invested some of his money in these two stocks. Unbeknownst to him, there was the consensus. There was some insight. Well, this is going on trial starting tomorrow, but this is the so-called Martoma trade. And he doesn't know that there's apparently or allegedly information coming to Martoma at SAC that is going to start to drive that stock down, and that they start to sell it. It drives it down. The pharmacist sits there, ends up losing $1 million. That's a victim. He was gamed.
Beyond that also, too, you know, one thing, you know, a lot of people point to, Colin, is that, you know, and these are valid arguments that, you know, it's a fraud on the marketplace. It destroys investor confidence. Those are very accurate descriptions in my mind, of what happens as a result of insider trading. But getting back to your point about the victims here, you know, a man named Professor Jeffrey Medora down at Florida Atlantic University did an interesting study. After the Raj Rajaratnam investigation was broken by the press, he found that in the following 26 months, that the average abnormal tick up in the stock price of companies that were about to be acquired in about the 2 week to 4 week period before the merger announcement was made, that number had been cut in half. And he estimated that it had saved acquiring companies $37 billion in abnormal control premiums. So $37 billion as a company would qualify you as 80th on the Fortune 500. That's Oracle. And they employ 50,000 people. So you're talking about a deleterious effect economically and financially on ordinary Americans, and especially at a time when people are having trouble finding work. People need to start thinking about insider trading in much more quantitative terms, not just qualitative terms. So, you know, and that's just one kind of, you know, one study that's been done. But certainly I'm sure there's a lot more out there if people look at it. But people really need to start thinking about insider trading as something that is taking money out of the pockets of ordinary people, because that's what's happening.
We're talking to Nick Verbitsky and Martin Smith, two of the men behind Front Lines to Catch a Trader, which will be airing Tuesday night at 10 p.m. on PBS, most PBS stations. We're going to run out of time here, and there's so much colorful stuff in this documentary, and I want to just maybe mention one or two things about it. I mean, and there are these great characters. There's one woman who really is actively involved through one of these so-called expert networks in supplying insider information to traders, and turns out among the things she wants in return, in addition to actual money, is $500 gift certificates to the Cheesecake Factory and live lobsters. Maybe my favorite moment of the movie. But, you know, one of the really colorful moments has to do with how you got one of the really interesting things that you got. Stephen Cohen is not available for interviews. He's not giving interviews. He's a relatively private, you know, some would say secretive, some would say reclusive kind of guy. He's certainly not going to give an interview to you guys. But you do have footage of him. Explain what that footage is and how you got it.
Yeah, we were able to obtain video footage of a civil deposition that Stephen Cohen gave in a lawsuit that was brought by a Canadian insurance company called Fairfax Financial. And it charged SAC, as well as Dan Loeb at Third Point, James Chanos at Kinnikos Associates, and others, with conspiring together to drive down the stock price of Fairfax over a period of time that would benefit some short bets that they had taken out. And, you know, I knew about the deposition because of a publicly released transcript, but there was no video. And, of course, Cohen buys up most of the photos that are taken of him in terms of the rights, so you can never use them. But I was contacted on an ordinary Tuesday this past summer via text by someone offering to give me excerpts of the deposition. And that communication went on for a number of days. And lo and behold, soon after, I was alerted to the fact that the video was downstairs across from the frontline offices at Rain Media in New York City, wedged in between two bars of a scaffolding across the street on a USB drive. And, of course, I hurriedly ran downstairs to get it and opened it up. And it was a USB drive with a big Bugs Bunny head on top of it. And it had on it a number of different excerpts from the deposition. And we were able to obtain more after that time. But, you know, it was kind of a little bit of a cloak and dagger action there when in terms of getting our hands on the video.
And this was a dead drop that we don't know what the source is, but this came about after a lot of effort on Nick's part to pry loose that that video.
All right, we're going to have to go. Nick Verbitsky and Martin Smith are, as I say, two of the people behind To Catch a Traitor. That's T-R-A-D-E-R, by the way, airing Tuesday night on January the 7th. That's this Tuesday night at 10 p.m. on PBS. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Colin, thank you.
Well, anyway, I do recommend that documentary. It's pretty gripping. One thing that's not in the documentary, I think it's not in the documentary, is that one of the odd qualities of these SAC traders is that when they get caught, they faint. Michael Martoma, I think, fainted on his front lawn in Florida when they showed up to get him. And then I think one of the other guys, Steinberg, fainted right after his – yeah, he fainted right after his conviction. So So if you're standing near them and something goes wrong, I mean, be careful. Be ready to catch them, I guess. We're going to switch gears here, as we do on Mondays pretty quickly, and tell you a story that kind of developed over the last 4 or 5 days. It involves a guy who's been on our show multiple times before. His name is Gary Greenberg. He's a psychotherapist and author, and he also has a website on which he writes blog posts, for want of a better word. So Gary Greenberg, a few days ago, I think it was January 3rd, was irked by a column by David Brooks of the New York Times. This was a column actually that did it irked a lot of people. It bothered a lot of people, and it created a lot of backlash on digital media. I even saw Frank Rich, who usually holds his fire in situations like this, particularly with a former colleague like David Brooks, vent a few splenetic tweets about this. But anyway, basically, the David Brooks column, I'm just sort of setting the stage here for Gary, who's with us right now. The David Brooks column basically claimed or talked about David Brooks' own youthful experimentations with marijuana and ultimately concluded that it had not made him a better or smarter person, and he was better off when he stopped smoking pot all the time or a lot of the time, and then sort of extended that to legalization laws or legalization efforts in states like Colorado and Washington, and suggested that it might not be really for the public good if more people became potheads. I think I'm more or less summarizing his argument. So Gary Greenberg joins us now, as I say, a psychotherapist, author, and contributor to Mother Jones, Harper's, The New York Times, Rolling Stones, and more, an occasional guest on our show. So, Gary Greenberg, I'll let you pick up the story from there. You didn't like the column any more than Frank Rich liked it, but you did something different, right? You decided to write a piece of satire.
Well, yeah. I mean, when I read this column, I was incensed, I guess is the right word. Even by Brooks's own standards, it was pretty bad. And usually, I just let that go. But I was making myself a cup of coffee, and this voice in my head said, "I smoked pot with David Brooks." And I realized I had to write that column. Now, I need to say right away, that's not true. I did not smoke pot with David Brooks when I was in high school. But I wrote a blog post about, as if I had, in which I detailed our hijinks, our youthful hijinks. And I wrote it, and I alerted my handful of followers on Twitter and a few other friends to its existence, and then I went out and lived my life. And while I was doing that, apparently, the internet media were in a flurry as to whether or not I was for sure, for real. And apparently, they spent a lot of time kicking this question back and forth, deciding whether or not I had really smoked pot with David Brooks when I was in high school.
Well, we should just say, I mean, a sample paragraph from the piece is, I remembered a time we were parked out at French Creek, and he stood up on top of the Vista Cruiser, that's his parents' Vista Cruiser, and gave a speech to us about what Jefferson really meant by the pursuit of happiness and how a government should uphold our right to get as high as possible and how George Washington grew pot and old Edmund Burke must have smoked it. And I wondered if Dave was sending his old posse a secret message. So, you know, some of the news outlets or some of the sort of digital news entities, as you say, some of them kind of kicked back and forth the question about whether this was real or not. But a number of them just kind of assumed that it was, right? I mean, a number of people were just sort of fooled by it and re-represented it to their audiences.
Yes, I think that's what happened. I mean, I came really late to that party, and so I really only have the word of the internet to take for that. But, yeah, it seems that that's what happened. A lot of people thought it was true, and despite the fact that it was outlandish, and despite the fact that there's plenty of information on my own blog to contradict some of the things that I said about myself and so on, they decided to go with it.
So, I mean, among the people who got in touch with you, people from The Atlantic, Salon, Slate, Gawker, HuffPo, Washington Examiner, The Daily Caller. The Daily Caller, by the way, is a sort of conservative website backed by Tucker Carlson or overseen by Tucker Carlson. And that's one of the places where you really had kind of a run-in with them, right? When they printed the story as if it were true or as if they basically believed that you had a valid story to tell, and when they were informed that it was satire, they were incensed.
Yeah, well, what happened was the woman from the Daily Caller emailed me, and I was—I didn't see it, and I didn't have time to respond even when I did see it, asking me whether or not, telling me she wanted to check the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than wait for me to respond, within less than an hour, she just went with her story, talking about how the guy, I think she called a dude, comes out with David Brooks or something like this. And when she found out, she was incensed and took to Twitter to call me a lot of names.
You've been praised in some quarters, and you've been called names in other quarters. And I think even Jake Tapper from CNN got mad at you and said, "Creative lying is not the same as satire." It kind of raises some questions, though, about what is legitimate satire, and whose responsibility is it to make the discrimination between what's real and what's satire? And what have you learned from all this, I guess, is what
well,
I'm
first
asking.
Of all, I still believe that it's the reader's responsibility to read.
Mm-hmm.
And if the stuff in that in my essay didn't at least ring their alarms a little bit enough to make them read carefully, then that shocks me. But I also think that it's the writer's responsibility when it begins to appear that people are taking him seriously and they don't mean to, that in a way that he didn't mean them to, it's the writer's responsibility to clarify it, which is exactly what I did. Anybody who asked me, I told them, no, it's satire. I mean, these websites you mentioned before, they were getting in touch with me, and they were saying, you know, can we cross-publish or whatever you call it, this thing? And I would write back, yeah, you can, but you do understand it's satire, right? And the response was almost universally, no, we didn't know that, but, you know, now that you mention it, we don't know who you are. So it was, which was fine. And then when I got tired of answering the question one at a time, I just put a note at the top of the essay saying, this is satire.
So there
and
are...
I believe that was my responsibility to do it, even though I don't think I should have to.
I mean, there are things in it. I mean, like the section that I read, which are simultaneously funny. I suppose it could be true. I mean, I suppose David Brooks, as a teenager, could have gotten stoned and climbed up on top of his parents' vehicle and started making speeches about Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and Edmund Burke and their respective connections to marijuana.
I suppose, but I think anybody vaguely familiar with David Brooks knows that at least he claims that at the beginning of his college career, anyway, he was not a conservative. He was not a fan of Edmund Burke. So whatever. I mean, yeah, those things are both funny and a little bit outlandish, but also believable in a way. And I think that's how good satire works.
And it is how good satire works. I mean, and I think part of good satire also is being misunderstood from time to time. Obviously, the most famous example of this, the one that everybody cites, is Jonathan Swift's Modest Proposal, where he basically proposed solving one problem by eating Irish children.
Right. So the way the critique works in there is that the reader is forced to decide, is this guy for real? And in the course of having to decide that, the reader has to confront his or her own prejudices and beliefs and assumptions and all of these things that only come to the surface in part because he's asking this important question, is this serious?
The difference, I suppose, is, and we'll probably end on this note or on this discussable point, too. One difference is that Swift existed in a slightly different media environment, too, and people had a little bit of time to chew things over. They still got it wrong. A lot of people misunderstood what Swift was saying. Here in this digital environment, this was sort of something that you wrote for maybe a lot of people who kind of know who you are anyway. I mean, you didn't try to sell it to Slate or Salon or any of the places that eventually got very interested in it. You put it up on your own site. You tweeted it out to your relatively modest group of Twitter followers, and I suppose that was sort of the limit of your expectations for it. There is kind of another lesson here, I guess, about the digital environment, how things can be pounced on and believed because people are in such a rush to believe things, in such a rush to cross-post things, get them up on their sites. People, of course, also believe what they want to believe, and so it's kind of, if it amuses them to think of David Brooks as a high school pothead doing really stupid things and standing up in class and saying gobble 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 one of us, then they're more likely to believe it also. I mean, as somebody who, you know, you're an author, you're a psychotherapist, you've written a lot about the environment we're in right now. Did you learn something else about digital life here, about how fast something like this can spread?
Yeah, I learned that I'm really glad that I'm not part of it because it's just impossible. I mean, I feel bad. These guys at Politico and whatever, they're on the wrong end of a fire hose. And that fire hose is spewing all sorts of horrible things, and their job is to somehow not even make sense of it, but to reflect it or amplify it or whatever it is they do, and they spend their days doing this. And I mean, it's inconceivable to me, and while I wish that it hadn't turned – well, I don't know if I wish it hadn't turned out this way. I'm sorry that there was all this consternation, but it also seems to me that this is a comment on the way that – the chattering classes are living now, which is, you know, moment to moment. And it's really frightening that there's no time or space for reflection. And clearly satire doesn't work if there's no time or space for reflection.
Probably not. Gary Greenberg, great to talk to you. I think your 15 minutes of this particular bout of fame are probably just about
it. Thank God.
All right. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. We'll take a break. We'll be back with our final segment, which is about panic attacks.
I guess now would be the wrong time to talk about how I used veterinary tranquilizers with Peggy Noonan and Ross Douthat. Don't do drugs with conservative commentators. It always comes out in the wash. Today's show was produced by the very sick Betsy Kaplan and me. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski. The part of Bill Curry was played by Liz Cheney. For links, articles, photos, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff resisting being sucked up into a polar vortex, visit our great website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, famous and not-so-famous roof collapses. And now, back to Colin.
That's right. Tomorrow tells the story of the Hartford Civic Center roof collapse, but also we have some engineers who investigated that who will also talk a little bit about more recent roof collapses, smaller buildings under big loads of snow, and how that problem is still not entirely solved. But we're going to spend quite a bit of time just talking about the story in 1978, and first of all, how incredibly close we came to a horrible, horrible disaster when that roof fell in and why that happened. Also, as the week goes along, we're going to do a show about the mysterious world of twins on Wednesday. On Thursday, David Edelstein and I will be huddling together here in the studio and arguing about movies. I'm seeing as many movies as I can right now. So that's still to come. Of course, Friday is always the news. We do want to especially thank our executive producer, Katie Tolarski, who's right now manning the phones today. So if you have any questions about our final segment, questions or comments about panic disorder, give us a call at 860-275-7266, and a very overqualified person will answer the phone. 860-275-7266. Also coming back to the show after many previous appearances, David Tolan. He's the founder and director of the Anxiety Disorder Center and Center for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy at the Institute of Living. They've got some new information, new research into the phenomenon known as a panic attack. So, David Tolan, first of all, welcome back to our show.
Thanks, Colin. Good to be with you.
And explain what we mean when we say panic attack.
Well, a panic attack is a burst of anxiety, although sometimes the person doesn't entirely recognize it as anxiety and it feels more physical. But the idea is that the set of bodily responses that we call the fight or flight system kicks into overdrive in a relatively short period of time. And so often this will peak within seconds to minutes, sometimes for reasons that the person can't understand, and they can seem to come out of the blue. But they, all of a sudden they notice that their heart is racing and their stomach is upset and that they're sweating and they're shaking and they're breathing hard, and sometimes they feel dizzy or lightheaded, like they're going to pass out, or sometimes it feels like they're going to throw up. And sometimes they even worry that maybe they're losing their mind or they're going to have a heart attack or something. So it's a really very frightening event in which it just seems like your body turns on you.
And it is a little bit tricky because the symptoms of a heart attack can mirror those of a panic attack and vice versa, right?
Well, there are some pretty important differences. And ultimately, the best way to do it is to get an EKG. But even by history, there are some things that you tend not to see in panic attacks. So, for example, pain radiating down the left arm is something that you wouldn't normally see in an anxiety or panic attack. And so, and similarly, an anxiety or panic attack can happen even when you're just sitting there all by yourself, whereas a heart attack becomes more likely under cases of exertion and things like that. So there are some important differences, but you're right. I mean, sometimes it's tough to tell the difference if you're just experiencing it.
And one of the things that seems to be happening with a panic attack is a kind of spiraling effect, right? You have one symptom, one anxiety symptom that's somatic in nature. It exhibits itself as a physical symptom. That, it seems, from what I'm reading and trying to understand here, can trigger a cascade of some of these other physical symptoms.
You're absolutely right. And actually, we didn't really become very aware of this particular cascade until this generation. So, a generation ago, I think this was a big head-scratcher to everybody, and nobody could understand why people had these recurrent panic attacks until they really started to take it apart. And they realize that there's a pretty predictable pattern here where you could be, sitting on your couch or something like that, and all of a sudden you notice that your heart is beating faster. Now, for you or me, we may just say, oh, well, that's weird, my heart's beating faster, and we don't really pay much more attention to it. But there are some people who focus in on it, and they say, oh my God, why is my heart beating faster? What does this mean? Does this mean something's wrong with me? Now, when you do that in your brain and you start asking, oh my God, is something wrong with me? What you start doing is sending out a threat message from your brain, which stimulates the fight or flight response. So now your heart starts to actually go faster. But in addition, you start to have the other physical sensations that come from the fight or flight response. Your breathing gets a little bit more shallow. Your muscles start to tense up. You might start shaking or sweating. Your stomach starts to tie up in knots. I mean, all of these are very understandable physical sensations. They happen for a reason. But if you're just sitting there and you don't understand the process, it just feels like you're having some kind of a medical catastrophe. And the next thing you know, for a lot of people, they're calling 911 and going to the emergency room.
Now, one of the most interesting things in your research, at least to me, and let's just imagine, just for speculative purposes, that maybe I've had some experiences like the ones you're describing.
I'm with you.
Is this notion of subtle hyperventilating? Explain about this, because, yeah. I mean, one of the things that happens if you're having a panic attack, one of the first, second, or third symptoms may be that you get really dizzy. So talk about that.
Well, this is something that we are really only now discovering. We always knew that hyperventilation played a big role in panic attacks, because if you're sitting there and you notice that your heart is racing and you start thinking something bad's happening and you feel your chest starting to tighten up, the first thing that comes to your mind is, oh my God, I better breathe deep and get more oxygen, otherwise I might suffocate or something. So you start sucking air. And of course, when you start sucking air, that just makes everything worse, because now you're hyperventilating and you're dizzy and you're lightheaded. So we've always known that hyperventilation played a role in that way, but it was only fairly recently that people were doing research in California, and they were hooking people with panic disorder up to long-distance telemetry units so that they could actually monitor them throughout the day. And what they found was that even throughout the day, they were engaging in a subtle hyperventilation, not big wind-sucking, but just breathing a little bit more deeply and a little bit more rapidly than most. And they weren't even aware that they were doing it. Now, what happens when you hyperventilate, even in a subtle way, is that your body starts retaining CO2, carbon dioxide. And so that builds up. Now, that's not harmful to you, but it can make you start to feel a lot more uncomfortable physical sensations. Kind of paradoxically, they're actually the same kinds of physical sensations that you get when you're suffocating, even though the cause is quite the opposite. So you get into this really nasty cycle where the person is subtly hyperventilating. They start feeling a whole lot of physical sensations because their body's hanging on to CO2. It feels to them like they're kind of suffocating, so they start breathing harder, and the next thing you know, they're spiraling into panic attacks.
We're talking to David Tolan right now. We got a call from Nicholas, which I think is going to lead us very appropriately into the next part of our conversation anyway. So Nicholas from Greenwich, what's on your mind?
Hi, Colin. Yeah, I think you may have touched upon it just in this most recent part of the discussion, but my girlfriend suffers from really severe panic attacks that don't seem to have any sort of noticeable catalyst. We've been going out for a very long time, but initially it's kind of, I don't want to seem crass, but it's kind of aggravating because there doesn't seem to be any sort of trigger for it. And she just says it's uncontrollable. Is there any way to mitigate them or to dial back on it, control them in any fashion?
That's exactly where we want to go next. Thank you very much, Nicholas.
That's a very good question, Nick. And there's sort of two parts to it. One is what do we make of the fact that these panic attacks just seem to come out of nowhere? And I think what we see when we really tease apart what's happening in a panic attack is that they are coming from somewhere, that they do have a cause, but the cause is internal rather than external. So if we start panicking, our first instinct is to look around and see what might be scaring me in the environment. Well, a lot of the time, there's nothing that's scaring me in the environment. What's happening, though, is I'm noticing a physical sensation that was not there before, or at least I wasn't noticing before, and I'm making some meaning of it. I'm telling myself that this means that something bad is about to happen to me, like I'm going to, you know, be sick, or I'm going to have a heart attack, or I'm going to die, or something like that. And so I'm scaring myself in response to my own physical sensations. With regard to the second part of the question, which is there anything that can be done? Absolutely. We've known for some time now, about a generation, that a kind of counseling called cognitive behavior therapy is highly, highly effective for panic attacks. I mean, it really effective to the extent that I don't think there's reason that anybody should need to continue to suffer from this. One of the ways that we do that is to help a person get used to the physical sensations that they experience that lead up to a panic attack so that they're not scared by them anymore, so they don't go into that panic cycle. But the other thing that we're trying now in research is to try to take care of that pattern of subtle hyperventilation by teaching people to be more aware of their breathing and learn not to hyperventilate themselves into a panic attack. And we're doing that now with some cutting-edge technology that allows you to actually see what your own respiration rate is and how much carbon dioxide you're blowing off so that you can learn to regulate your own breathing in a way that is not conducive to having more panic attacks.
We're going to have to sort of pretty much end it here, but this is fascinating stuff, David Tolan. And one last question. Has anybody ever tried to figure out what percentage of the population has these over the course of a lifetime?
Absolutely. Well, if you're talking about panic attacks, it is most of the population.
I think that's right, yeah.
Almost all of us either have experienced or will experience a panic attack at some point for some reason. But if you're talking about, you know, panic disorder, which is where the person is having these self-sustaining panic attacks that come out, seemingly out of the blue and are happening again and again and again, that's about 1 in every 100 people.
Mm. We should mention very quickly, because we're running out of time here, the thing you were talking about before, that sort of the cutting-edge stuff that allows people to sort of see what their respiration rate is and their CO2 rates and stuff, this is all kind of interfaces with an iPad, right?
That's exactly right, yeah. So it actually becomes something that you take home and potentially don't even need to talk to the therapist about. It is what we're finding, and the data so far look very promising, is that people can actually learn to get control of this on their own, but they just need to have the right tools and the right plan.
It's like Candy Crush, but it makes your anxiety attacks go away. All right, thanks so much for joining us, David Tolan. Thanks to everybody who helped out today. Poor Betsy Kaplan is homesick again. We hope she gets better. Thanks to Katie Tolarski for stepping in. I try not to hang out too much, try not to watch too much television, but still everything I do just seems to be the wrong decision, and I lay down every night, but still I can't get no rest, 'cause it starts spinning in my brain, and then it's pounding in my
my chest. It's an anxiety attack, an anxiety attack. I've got a bad case of the horrors, and at night it comes back.
Hey, Henry, what's wrong?
I'm having a panic attack. I think they found out about the insider trading. I think I'm going to be sent to prison and my life is ruined.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Just slow your roll. All you need to do is calm down.
Oh, calm down. I never thought of that. Thanks, Kyone. You're amazing.
Just doing my job, Henry. Just doing my job.